Nicotine can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s,
affecting learning, memory, attention, and impulse control, and priming the brain for other addictions.
Vaping products also come in kid-friendly flavors that can make them appealing to youth.
And many kids also use other drugs, like marijuana, in vaping devices.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media,
many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping, because when you talk, they hear you.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
I let go of trying to control things that I had no control over, and that helped me find peace of mind.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
I was constantly stressed and worried. Now I approach each day with joy and gratitude.
In Al-Anon, families and friends of alcoholics find new ways to heal from the effects of a loved one's drinking.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We are slowly dying every day. Is there anyone on this planet who can survive what a human is living through in Gaza? I don't think anyone can bear what we are bearing. It has been 2 years of the war, hunger, killing, destruction, and displacement.
The United Nations is warning 14,000 babies could die in Gaza over the next 48 hours if aid doesn't reach them. As Israel expands its assault and vows to take full control of the entire Gaza Strip, we'll go to Gaza to speak with an Oxfam representative, then to Tel Aviv, to the editor at 972, to talk about his piece, Render It Unusable, Israel's mission of total urban destruction. Then to the campus of Columbia University here in New York, where Palestinian student Mohsen Madawi graduated on Monday. Ago, Mohsen Madawi was released from a Vermont prison after being arrested by immigration agents at his naturalization interview.
There is joy that also the Trump's administration and this unjust government that tried to keep me in prison. I am on university campus, not in prison. I am in my graduation clothes, not in my prison clothes.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The UN is warning 14,000 babies could die in Gaza in the next 48 hours without immediate aid. 100 aid trucks have been approved for entry into Gaza today, far short of the number needed, but a big jump after fewer than 10 trucks were permitted to enter Gaza on Monday. The slow trickle of aid was the first food allowed into Gaza since Israel imposed a total blockade 11 weeks ago. A UN official called the limited supplies a drop in the ocean as the population of over 2 million is facing famine. The leaders of Canada, France, and the UK, all staunch allies of Israel, warned they could move to sanction Israel unless it halts its stepped-up offensive on Gaza and allows unfettered aid access. Separately, 23 of Israel's allies signed a joint statement calling for a, quote, full resumption of aid into Gaza immediately, unquote. Israeli forces continue to bombard Gaza overnight, killing at least 73 more Palestinians, including in Khan Yunis, after the Israeli military ordered residents of the southern city to flee as it launched a major ground invasion and vowed to take control over the entire territory. Israel also attacked another school-turned-shelter in Gaza City. Israeli strikes on Gaza's hospitals also continue. The World Health Organization Monday condemned an attack on Nasser Hospital, which destroyed one-third of a medical supplies warehouse. This is the hospital's director, Dr. Atef Al-Hout.
We now have nearly 30 patients in the intensive care unit, and I have 7 patients who need intensive care in the emergency room that I can't find space for. Until when will this silence continue? Until when will the Security Council stand idly by? Until when will the United Nations, the European Union, and other institutions stand watching this situation?
Yemen's Houthi movement announced Monday it's escalating its actions in support of Palestinians and said it would impose a naval blockade on Israel's port of Haifa.
The armed forces will not hesitate, with Allah's help, to take the necessary additional measures in support of our oppressed Palestinian people and their esteemed resistance.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled Monday to allow the Trump administration to remove Biden-era protections that shielded nearly 350,000 Venezuelan immigrants from deportation. The unsigned two-paragraph order gave no reasons for lifting an injunction by a federal judge in San Francisco who ruled that removing TPS, that's temporary protected status for Venezuelan asylum seekers, would, quote, inflict irreparable harm on hundreds of thousands of persons whose lives, families, and livelihoods will be severely disrupted, cost the United States billions in economic inactivity, and injure public health and safety, unquote. An attorney representing Venezuelan immigrants called Monday's ruling, quote, the largest single action stripping any group of non-citizens of immigration status in modern U.S. history, unquote. The Justice Department Monday charged New Jersey Congressmember LaMonica McIver with assault against federal agents over the clash at a Newark immigration detention center earlier this month. Congressmember McIver was at the ICE jail for an oversight visit with two other Democratic congressmembers and Newark Mayor Ross Baraka, who was arrested at that time. On Monday, the interim U.S. attorney for New Jersey, Alina Haba, who was also Trump's personal lawyer, announced she's dismissing a misdemeanor trespassing charge against Baraka. Congressmember McIver said in a statement, quote, the charges against me are purely political. They mischaracterize and distort my actions and are meant to criminalize and deter legislative oversight, she said. The ACLU warned, quote, if the Trump administration can target elected officials who oppose its extreme agenda, it can happen to any one of us, unquote. President Trump has dropped his demand that Russia declare an immediate ceasefire in Ukraine following a two-hour phone call with President Vladimir Putin Monday that Trump described as excellent. Trump said after the call that Moscow and Kyiv should start direct negotiations instead of U.S.-mediated talks aimed at ending Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Last year, Trump promised he would end the Ukraine war in 24 hours. After the call, Putin said he declined the U.S. proposed 30-day ceasefire and said Russia's goals in Ukraine remain unchanged. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of trying to buy time in order to continue its war and occupation. European defense ministers have just announced new sanctions against Russia, the European Union's 17th sanctions package since Russia invaded Ukraine more than 3 years ago. The EU's foreign policy chief said she hoped to see the consequences against Russia that Trump promised if Putin failed to agree to an unconditional ceasefire.
It takes two to want peace. It only takes one to want war. And Russia clearly wants war, whereas Ukraine wants peace. So in order to make Russia want peace, also we need to put more pressure on Russia.
European nations are preparing to lift economic sanctions on Syria as the country rebuilds following the collapse of Bashar al-Assad's rule. This follows President Trump's announcement last week that the U.S. would lift sanctions on Damascus. More details on the agreement could come later today as the EU summit in Brussels continues. Leaders of the United Kingdom and the European Union hailed what they're calling a reset as they signed a series of fresh deals on trade and defense 5 years after Brexit. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer called the deal a win-win as he spoke alongside his European counterparts.
People. In uncertain times, a new era for defence, security and trade, we will do that by strengthening our relationships with allies around the world, including, of course, with Europe. So that is what today is all about, moving on from stale old debates, looking forward, not backwards.
The agreement seeks to facilitate trade, including by easing checks on certain animal and plant products. It also extends European access to UK waters for fishing and makes travel between the UK and EU easier. Britain's opposition Conservative Party accused Starmer of surrendering to an EU-dominated system and backtracking on Brexit. The UN is calling for investigation into reports that Indian authorities in New Delhi rounded up dozens of Rohingya refugees, including children, then took them by ship to the Andaman Sea, where they pushed them into the open water near Burma's coast with nothing but life jackets. Their whereabouts remain unknown. The move by the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi comes amidst an intensifying crackdown on Muslim minorities across India, and as tensions escalate with neighboring Pakistan. The World Health Organization is warning people in dozens of countries are going without needed medical care due to global funding cuts.
In at least 70 countries, patients are missing out on treatments. Health facilities have closed. Health workers have lost their jobs. And people face increased out-of-pocket health spending.
That was World Health Organization Director Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who warned WHO is facing a $600 million gap in its annual budget, with more steep cuts ahead as the U.S. withdraws support for global health programs and prepares to exit the organization. Separately, the WHO voted in favor of a major new global treaty to improve pandemic preparedness and vaccine access. The U.S. was not part of those talks since it decided to withdraw from the WHO. Parts of the treaty still need to be agreed upon before it can be ratified. The U.S. Senate has confirmed the billionaire real estate developer Charles Kushner as U.S. ambassador to France. Kushner is the father of Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. In 2020, Trump pardoned him for federal crimes, including witness tampering, after Kushner hired a prostitute to seduce his brother-in-law with instructions to secretly record the affair and to send video to Kushner's own sister. ProPublica reports Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy sold stock in 34 companies in February, just 2 days before President Trump announced plans to impose steep tariffs on foreign imports, setting off unprecedented stock market volatility. Duffy is at least the second cabinet secretary to have sold shares with apparent insider knowledge. ProPublica reports Attorney General Pam Bondi sold between $1 to $5 million worth of shares of Trump's social media company on April 2nd, what Trump called Liberation Day, just before Trump announced steep new tariffs on most countries, sending markets into a tailspin. Maryland Governor Wes Moore has come under fire after he vetoed a state bill to study reparations as a remedy to the lasting economic and human harms caused by slavery and racism. Three other Democratic states have successfully passed reparations bills in recent years: California, Illinois, and New York. Governor Moore is the country's only sitting black governor and is widely seen as a potential Democratic candidate for president in 2028. Maryland's legislative black caucus condemned Moore's move and suggested lawmakers would override his veto. In Louisiana, the New Orleans Police Department has reportedly paused its sweeping use of real-time facial recognition technology amidst massive backlash following a Washington Post expose. New Orleans police reportedly used a private network of more than 200 surveillance cameras and facial recognition technology to constantly monitor public streets with no oversight. And despite a 2022 city ordinance that limited the use of facial recognition by police, the technology was provided by the nonprofit Project NOLA, which operates out of the University of New Orleans. The Post expose said the surveillance method is, quote, without a known precedent in any major American city that may violate municipal guardrails around use of the technology, unquote. Another college graduate is being denied a diploma after speaking out for Palestinian rights. Palestinian-American Sarin Haddad has been organizing at Virginia Commonwealth University with Students for Justice in Palestine. The group's actions have been repeatedly targeted and repressed by VCU administration, including banning the use of sidewalk chalk to write messages on the campus. This is Sarin Haddad.
VCU claims to uplift marginalized voices unless those voices call out genocide, and they claim to celebrate diversity until that diversity challenges the status quo. And they claim to teach critical thinking but punish those who think critically about empire, occupation, and ethnic cleansing. VCU wants me to choose silence over justice and comfort over courage and a diploma over my people. I have lost over 200 family members in this ongoing genocide just in the last year and a half.
Serene's father is the Palestinian-American doctor and leader Tariq Haddad, who last year refused to meet with then-Secretary of State Antony Blinken over the Biden administration's support of Israel's assault on Gaza. You can see our interview with Dr. Haddad at the time at democracynow.org. Education advocates are raising the alarm after Oklahoma approved a new high school social studies curriculum, which will encourage students to identify discrepancies, quote unquote, in the 2020 election with Donald Trump, which Donald Trump lost, but has repeatedly falsely claimed he won. Oklahoma school superintendent is a Trump supporter who's tapped other far-right ideologues to revise the state's curriculum, including Kevin Roberts, president of the Heritage Foundation. In other education news, thousands of school teachers protested in front of Elon Musk's SpaceX facility in Hawthorne, California, Saturday. The teachers condemned DOGE's dismantling of the education department and cuts to special education and student meal programs. The Trump administration has moved to allow the sale of devices that turn semi-automatic rifles like the AR-15 into fully automatic machine guns. The Justice Department said Friday it had reached a settlement abandoning a legal fight to ban the device called Forced Reset Trigger, first brought by the Biden administration. Gun control groups condemned the move, saying the Trump administration has effectively legalized machine guns. And Republican lawmakers in Missouri have passed a referendum that, if approved by voters, would restore the state's near-total ban on abortion. Last week, Missouri Republicans invoked a rarely used rule to shut down a Democratic filibuster blocking the vote. In November, Missouri voters approved a measure that enshrined abortion rights into the state's constitution. The Republican-led referendum does not need the governor's signature and is expected to appear on the November 2026 ballot. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The UN's humanitarian chief, Tom Fletcher, is warning 14,000 babies could die in Gaza over the next 48 hours if more aid does not enter the besieged Gaza Strip. Fletcher issued the warning during an interview on the BBC earlier today.
The situation is dire. The real test of the words will be whether we can get that aid in. We are there on the border right now. We have thousands of trucks ready to go. We know how to do this. We've done it before. And we are demanding that the world back us in pushing Israel to let us get in and reach those people who are starving right now.
And yesterday it was five trucks of aid that went in, not fit for purpose in this case.
No, that's a drop in the ocean. And let's be clear, those five trucks are just sat on the other side of the border right now. They've not reached the communities they need to reach. And, you know, let me describe what is on those trucks. This is baby food. Baby nutrition. There are 14,000 babies that will die in the next 48 hours unless we can reach them.
That was UN humanitarian chief Tom Fletcher on the BBC today. The Euromed Human Rights Monitor reported two of the five aid trucks that entered Friday contained burial shrouds, not food. The group's head, Rami Abdu, said, quote, "This isn't food. It's preparation for mass death. Gaza isn't being fed, it's being buried," unquote. This comes as Israel expands its military assault on Gaza, with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowing to take full control of the entire Gaza Strip. Netanyahu's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, has openly said Israel's, quote, cleansing Gaza. In recent days, Israeli military attacks by air, land and sea have killed hundreds of Palestinians, including at least 73 Palestinians so far today. One Israeli strike today killed 22 Palestinians at a displacement shelter in Gaza City. On Monday, Israel ordered the forced evacuation of Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city. Displaced residents said they had nowhere to go.
"We are the residents of Bani Sehala. We don't know where to go. We are innocent and unarmed civilians. We don't know where to go. We want them to stop the war. We have no business in all what's happening. May God take revenge."
"Where are you taking your son now?"
"He is my nephew. His father is a martyr. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know."
We go now to Gaza City, where we're joined again by Mahmoud Al-Saka, Oxfam's food security and livelihoods coordinator in Gaza. Mahmoud, welcome back to Democracy Now! We last spoke to you exactly a week ago from your office there in Gaza City. Since then, Israel's bombardment of Gaza has intensified. Palestinians are fleeing Khan Yunis, the second largest city in Gaza, and Israeli attacks killed hundreds of Palestinians over the weekend, including five journalists. Can you describe the situation at this point, as Israel saying they are partially lifting the blockade? Talk about what's getting in, what's getting out, how many trucks are needed to come into Gaza at this point.
Thank you for having me again. Unfortunately, the situation since our last meeting has been not even improved. It's in contrast. It's deteriorating. And what's happening right now in the Gaza is really heartbreaking. The conditions of the families, of our friends, of the people here become truly unbearable. And the suffering is really beyond description. Yeah, I agree with you. There are some trucks. We are talking about five trucks coming into Gaza yesterday, but it's merely a drop in the ocean compared to the overwhelming needs of the Gazans. Imagine that people here in Gaza are starving since more than 77 days due to the Israeli full blockade, without having any supplies in either food, medical, or any humanitarian supplies. And now we are talking about just five trucks that it could be support in responding to this needs. Just before this full blockade, during the ceasefire phase, we used to have 600 trucks per day. So now we are talking about five trucks. Even if it's increased in the coming days, it could reach 30 trucks, but it's nothing compared to the high needs of the people here in Gaza. Just to give you also, how is the situation on the ground? The people now are really suffering. Children are crying out in hunger, and even most of the time they are going to sleep hungry. The parents, the father, the mothers are now preferring to be just die without having or seeing their children in such a position, and they didn't have any power to help in that regards. This is what we are witnessing right now.
And Mahmoud, ever since the Israel ended the ceasefire, What has been the presence of Israeli soldiers within Gaza? Because it's, obviously Benjamin Netanyahu keeps talking about a major offensive. To what degree is the Israeli military occupying major sections of Gaza?
You know, right now, in parallel to this, all these things happening, they are intensifying their offensive military operation in the Gaza Strip. As you already said, there is an evacuation orders for a new areas of the Gaza Strip. The whole North Governorate and the whole Khan Yunis Governorate are now under evacuation order. We are now talking more than 70% of the Gaza Strip under such no-go zones or evacuation orders. And you can imagine the conditions of the people who have been displaced without having any belongings and without having any means of survival. These conditions is also as a priority, and we are expecting the worst is coming, as they are all the nights and over the day, they are just bombarding everywhere in the Gaza Strip, in the evacuated areas and even in the uncrowded areas, in the shelters and makeshift camps, where it's like the essentials for the people to survive in these situations. You can imagine the crowdedness that nowadays in the Gaza Strip, where a lot of people are crowded in a tiny places. And this is like any essentials for public health, for food, for any survival means in that time.
On Friday, President Trump told reporters, quote, a lot of people are starving in Gaza. And he said he wanted to help reduce the suffering. But what has the United States actually done, from what you can tell, in terms of relieving the suffering of the Palestinians there?
Unfortunately, we were expecting more during this visit, to be honest, in reaching a permanent and lost ceasefire. But unfortunately, until now, we didn't have anything. During the last few days, we have an increasing international pressure, which was good. After 19 months of this suffering of the people in Gaza Strip, we are seeing some people are really making some pressure to the Israeli. And this is why we are afraid that this is limited gesture of having some aids in. It's likely made under this pressure, and it's not a genuine step from the Israeli side towards resolving this humanitarian catastrophe. What we are looking for right now is to make this pressure and to hold Israel accountable to this full blockade, inhuman blockade, so they can open this borders. And we can, as a humanitarian agencies, can work in supporting those people in needs. And also at the same time, while we are asking for this opening of the borders, we are asking for the ceasefire, because the people are really exhausted during the last 19 months of having constant fear and having all these displacement times for the people. So we need this opening of the borders. We need to have this a ceasefire that could be last and could be permanent ceasefire, so we can, as agencies, can provide the support for the people. The Americans and the Israeli, now they are providing and introducing a new mechanism for aid, and which is, as we have reiterated, that it is not in line with the international humanitarian law. It's excluding the elderly and the sick, the people with disabilities. We as organization, UN agencies and international NGOs, we have the infrastructure in place, and we have a rigorous system in that regards, and we have our operation in place. So it's no need to reinvent a new tool or mechanism. All that is needed is to allow the organization to work freely in supporting the people in need without enforcing the people to go to a militarized zones to get their supplies from, which is unprotected and inhuman for the world. And it's just reiterate that Israeli is weaponizing and instrumentalizing the aid as a tool of control.
Your response to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying that Israel is going for total victory in Gaza?
What is the meaning of total victory of Gaza? Is the meaning of total victory that we are killing hundreds of people on a daily basis? Are our total victory is to displace the people multiple times? Nowadays, some families have been displaced for more than 20 times. You can imagine what's the meaning of displacement. I'm sure that most of the people already seen some pictures and scenes where the elderly people are enforced to flee their places, walking on the streets in a very weak infrastructure and trying to evacuate from these areas without having any belongings or without having any means. So what is the total victory means? The total victory is to support the people, is to be accountable for the international humanitarian law, not breaches or violating or continuous this offensive military operation on the Gazans and in the innocent people here in Gaza Strip. All the people who are being killed, and you are seeing that most of the people who were killed are children and women, and this is not that like the victory could be.
Mahmoud Al-Sakka, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Oxfam's Food Security and Livelihoods Coordinator in Gaza, joining us now from Gaza City. When we come back, a new expose from the news outlet 972. Its headline, Render It Unusable, Israel's Mission of Total Urban Destruction. We'll go to Tel Aviv. Stay with us.
Wasn't born yesterday, but I remember the way things used to be. I know that it was never perfect, but we did not have the problems that we see. Tell me why, what is the reason good people have to die? Oh my, I could tell you all a lie, but I wish I didn't have to say goodbye. Goodbye, say goodbye. Hi, say goodbye. Hi, say goodbye. Hi, say goodbye. Well, I keep hearing more.
Say Goodbye by Michael Franti in our Democracy Now! Studio back in 2014. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to a new report that reveals how Israel is trying to make Gaza unlivable. It's been well documented that Israeli airstrikes account for mass casualties. Now the independent news outlet 972 magazine has spoken to Israeli soldiers who reveal new details about how they've been systematically using bulldozers and explosives to flatten Gaza from the ground. For example, Gaza's government media office says the Israeli army's destroyed at least 90% of residential neighborhoods in the southern city of Raqqa. The 972 report features videos Israeli soldiers shared online, like this one by Avraham Zarviv, who operates a D9 armored bulldozer. His nickname is Flattener of Jabalia, the northern town of Jabalia in Gaza. In this video, he uses his camera to show a flattened landscape in Rafah.
Very good. Givati Brigade, very good. Yes, Rafah. Rafah end, as they say. There will be no more battle in Rafah, because there will be no more Rafah. The nation of Israel lives.
For more, we're joined in Tel Aviv by Meron Rappaport, editor and writer at the independent Israeli news site Local Call and a columnist at 972 Magazine, where his new piece with Oren Ziv is headlined, Render It Unusable, Israel's Mission of Total Urban Destruction. Meron, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you lay out what you found and these the access you had, well, because they post them online publicly, to these Israeli soldiers' actual video accounts themselves of what they're doing in Gaza?
I think that Gaza is being destroyed and is already destroyed. This is not really new. We know that. We know that there are very few buildings standing in Rafah. What we have discovered in this investigation, Orenziv and I, is that this is a premeditated, that most of it is premeditated, that this is the routine work of soldiers today, or in the last year, or maybe more than a year, since the beginning of 2024, the routine work is to destroy, that this is what they are doing as a routine army service. They go out in the morning, they either accompany bulldozers or a unit that is responsible for explosives, they go, choose buildings and flatten them in a systematic way, and that the aim is quite, it is being said to them, of course, this is not official orders coming from the general headquarters of the Israeli army, but this is very bluntly told, they're being told, and they are themselves very proud of it, that the real aim is to make it impossible for the Palestinian to return to these areas. We have seen that now in these days in Rafah. We are telling that 4% of the building in Rafah are unhurt, undamaged. Only 4%, a city of 200,000 people before the war. So it is a systematic thing. It's not done by, it's not during battle. It's not even a result of airstrike, although, of course, airstrike are responsible for some of the damage. It is a planned thing, and in this, I think it is unprecedented.
And Marin, you open your piece quoting a soldier you identify only as Y, and he describes the demolition methods, and I'm quoting you. You write, quote, "I secured four or five bulldozers from another unit. They demolished 60 houses per day, 6-0. A one- or two-story house they take down within an hour. A three- or four-story house takes a bit longer. The official mission was to open a logistical route for maneuvering, but in practice, the bulldozers were simply destroying homes." So this is, to reiterate what you said, this is not in the process of a battle. This is supposedly after, let's say, there's been a battle or conflict, what the Israeli soldiers are doing. So this is total ethnic cleansing of an entire territory. It's effectively what they're doing, isn't it?
Effectively, yes. Of course, this is goes into some gray zone in the international law, what is called domicide, destruction of whole urban areas. It is not officially a crime against humanity. It is certainly against the laws of war to destroy buildings that have nothing to do with military action. But yes, I think there's no doubt that the intention here is ethnic cleansing. The intention here is to make these cities, Rafah, Jabalia, the Netzarim corridor, for the moment, maybe we are seeing something new in the next days, but to make these areas completely impossible, it will be completely impossible for the population to come back because there is nothing left. And it is being said quite openly by the soldiers, by the videos that they air themselves, by soldiers who spoke to us. It is quite clear that this is the intention. Now, the IDF, in its official response to us, said that, no, this is part of operational, there's operational needs that require this demolition operations of houses, and this has to do only with operational needs, houses or building where there were they shoot at Israeli soldiers, or there were explosives. Hamas planted explosive in these houses. But what we are seeing is so clear. And again, Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu himself, said that we are destroying house by house, so they will have nowhere to come back to. Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, said just yesterday that we are not leaving even one stone standing. So it's very clear that the IDF reaction is not based on reality.
And did you discover any moral qualms among some of the Israeli soldiers that you interviewed about this practice?
Yes, of course. The soldiers that talked with us didn't feel good or felt very bad with what they were doing. And this is the reason they talked to us. We talked about 10 soldiers, but they also said that this is such a routine now for Israeli soldiers that they don't really, that most of the soldiers do not pay much attention, because this is the routine. This is what they do. There's very little real fighting. And one soldier who spent 3 months in the Netzarim corridor said that he had very, very little real fighting in all these 3 months. And the routine work was to, if there were enough explosive, because sometimes there were not enough explosive, but if there were enough explosive, they would go in the morning, choose between 5, 10 houses to demolish, and this is the routine work. So the soldiers really were very used to it. And of course, there were these soldiers that were politically motivated, right-wing soldiers, that really rejoiced in the fact that these Palestinians will have nowhere to return to. But this is not the main, I would say, atmosphere. The atmosphere is, this is the work we are doing, and we just do it. That's what we are sent for.
Meron Rapoport, I wanted to ask you about Microsoft's support for Israel. The Associated Press reports that Microsoft has now acknowledged it sold advanced artificial intelligence and cloud computing services to the Israeli military during the war in Gaza and aided in efforts to locate and rescue Israeli hostages, unquote. Microsoft confirmed this in an unsigned blog post. On Monday, a Microsoft worker who's a member of the No Azure for Apartheid disrupted Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella's keynote address at the company's flagship Build event in Seattle, Washington.
Satya, how about you show him how Microsoft is killing Palestinians? How about you show them how Israeli war crimes are powered by Azure? As a Microsoft worker, I refuse to be complicit in this genocide.
I wanted, Meron, to get your response to these developments and what we know about Microsoft's role, as you've edited reports by 972 on Microsoft, including one in January headlined, "Leaked Documents Expose Deep Ties Between Israeli Army and Microsoft," in a piece that was written by Yuval Abraham, who won the Oscar for being a co-director of the film No Other Land. Meron.
Yes, it seems that this is, of course, there was this report by Yuval, and then there was a previous report quoting mainly Israeli sources, open sources, the head of and a unit that is responsible for computing in the Israeli army, that she said that they received essential help to the Israeli war machine from this big three cloud companies, Azure and we had these documents that we revealed, that Yuval revealed later on. So the relationship is certainly very close, and it does seem that this creates problems for Microsoft internally, and maybe externally and internally. We have to see. We have maybe other reports coming. I think this story is not over.
And Meron Rappaport, you have the United Nations reported in March that from March 2025, since the beginning of 2024, Israel has demolished 463 buildings in the West Bank as part of a military activity, and it's displaced nearly 40,000 Palestinians from several cities in the West Bank. Could you talk about that? And also, you've reported that in Lebanon, Israel used similar demolition operations.
It does seem that this has become really part of the Israeli war, the modus operandi of Israeli army, destruction per se, not during fighting. We have seen that in Lebanon. We had reports in our investigation in which a soldier was told in advance that what he is going to do is to destroy the Shiites' villages in Lebanon even before he came in. So it didn't have anything, it didn't have direct relation to the fightings. And
Meron,
it seems that this way of action, it seems that this is way of action is being copied and employed in the West Bank as well.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Meron Rappaport, editor and writer at the independent Israeli news site Local Call and a columnist at Plus 972 magazine. We'll link to your new article, Render It Unusable, Israel's Mission of Total Urban Destruction. Meron was speaking to us from Tel Aviv. Coming up, Palestinian student Mohsen Madawi graduates from Columbia University 3 weeks after he was released from a Vermont prison after being targeted by the Trump administration. Stay with us.
Ours is just another skin, simply slips away. You can rise above it, it will shed easily. It all will come out fine. I've learned it line by line. One coming wire, one silver thread, all that you desire rolls on ahead.
Grateful. By Patti Smith in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We end today's show on the campus of Columbia University, where graduation ceremonies are being held this week. On Monday, Palestinian student Mohsen Madawi walked across the stage to receive his GS diploma from the Columbia University School of General Studies. Students erupted in thunderous applause. There was a standing ovation. Mohsen Madawi's path to graduation was not an easy one. In mid-April, he was arrested in Vermont when he appeared for what he'd been told was his naturalization interview. After the interview, he was taken away by armed, masked, and hooded federal agents. Mohsen moved to Vermont from the occupied West Bank in 2014, where he lived in El Farah, a Palestinian refugee camp. At Columbia University, he was co-president of Columbia's Palestinian Students Union and served as president of Columbia University's Buddhist Association for 2 years. Mohsen is one of several students who've been detained by the Trump administration. His former classmate, Mahmoud Khalil, is still locked up in Louisiana since early March. Mohsen Madawi spent 2 weeks in a Vermont prison before a federal judge in Vermont ordered him released on bail. The judge, Jeffrey Crawford, compared the recent detentions of immigrant student protesters to the Red Scare and the Palmer raids. Crawford ruled Madawi should stay in Vermont but could come to New York for educational purposes. When the government objected to him crossing Vermont lines to come to New York, the judge responded, Mohsen Madawi could travel to New York to attend his graduation at Columbia. The judge went on to write, quote, During his time in New York State, Mr. Madawi is permitted to move freely, conduct his daily activities normally, including but not limited to meeting with elected officials, speaking with and being interviewed by members of the press and media, speaking at public events, attending protests, the judge wrote. On Friday, Mohsen appeared in our Democracy Now! Studio for his first live interview since being released from prison. Well, on Monday, I met up with Mohsen again and spoke to him just after he graduated.
My name is Mohsen Madawi, and I just graduated from the School of General Studies.
And how do you feel? Talk about walking up on the stage and your thoughts today.
A mix of feelings, some conflicting feelings. There is a strong sense of joy that I am able to come to this university all the way from a refugee camp to survive the war, to be able to continue holding on hope, to climb the wall, the 30-foot wall on a constructed ladder and come down by a rope, to make it to America in order to be able to fulfill my uncle's dream, which is education is hope and education is life. So there is joy in that. There is sadness that my uncle is not here to witness this. And there is sadness that my family, my parents, could not leave the West Bank and come and see this moment. And there is sadness that there are no universities left in Gaza where students can experience such a joy, where hope can be harnessed in universities. And there is joy that also the Trump's administration and this unjust government that tried to keep me in prison. I am on university campus, not in prison. I am in my graduation clothes, not in my prison clothes. And I am celebrating here around the buffet, not having the 20 minutes prepared meal in the prison. So if this is something, this is the hope that I give, the light that I give to the American people, to the good American people who have supported me, to the Vermonters, to the people who fought for justice. It's a hope that democracy is functioning. The justice system that gave me the order to be here is in place, and that our fight for justice, our fight for peace, is a fight for humanity, not only for the Palestinian people.
The judge rebuked the government when they said you couldn't travel over state lines from Vermont, where you were just released from jail, to your graduation. Can you explain what he said?
Judge Crawford has been a person who's holding the scale of justice very firmly. This is what I am fighting for. Justice and peace go hand in hand. This is what I want. And Judge Crawford has granted me to come to New York City to participate in events, in protests. That's my free speech right, First Amendment right in this country. And has granted me the chance to be with the community that I love. And they love me and they love them. You saw how they cheered me up. Doesn't matter what the Trump administration is saying and accusing me of. Columbia University gave the answer, and it comes from the students and from the professors, not from senior administration or from unjust government or unjust laws.
You got a standing ovation when you graduated. Can you talk about how you felt at that point?
I felt honored and humbled. I felt that the inner child who has suffered and the story of many other children who are suffering and who have suffered is being seen and acknowledged. And I felt that people stood up for justice, for peace, for human rights, and for international law. This is my message, a message of peace, a message for justice.
What did you think of the valedictory, the valedictorian who referenced the number of people who are not here at graduation?
He's a very brave man. And you have to keep in mind that he comes from an Irish heritage, from resilience, from resistance, from understanding injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, as Martin Luther King has said. What this university is doing is ridiculous. They are suspending students. They are expelling students just for protesting against the war. What kind of values this university would have if it doesn't allow itself to align with international law and human rights? What worth our degrees? You see the names of philosophers, you see the names of philosophers engraved on buildings in these universities, the most significant ones, Law Library and Butler Library. What is the point if we are studying those philosophers and we are just not bringing those theories into action? Justice, education, interconnectedness, peace, harmony, empathy, forgiveness. This university is a betrayal to all of those values. And what it's doing here is segregating and destroying the democratic system that depends on votes, on sharing voices. And they're telling the students and the professors, you don't matter, but the student's voice is much louder than the money that the university receives.
We're standing next to SIPA, the school you hope to go to in the fall. Do you think you'll be able to? You're in an immigration proceeding now, even though you were going towards naturalization and U.S. citizenship.
Look, I plan on attending SIPA. There are many obstacles. Obstacles with the immigration system, obstacle with the federal justice system, and an obstacle with this university that refused to give me a scholarship. They gave me zero funding, even though they accepted me based on merit. But I tell them that I am coming here to be in the middle of this fire, because I am a peacemaker, because I am a firefighter. And I will come here to study international affairs, focusing on diplomacy and security, and focusing on conflict resolution and peacemaking. This is the story of hope, from a refugee camp to Colombia.
From a refugee camp to Colombia, Palestinian student activist Mohsen Madawi speaking after graduating from Columbia University on Monday, just 3 weeks after a federal judge had him released from a Vermont prison. During his interview, Mohsen Madawi referenced the valedictorian address by the Irish student Peter Gorman.
Good morning to the 2025 graduates of the School of General Studies, and congratulations. I can't say how shocked and honored I was to find myself as your valedictorian this year. It begs a question. How does one speak to these people I found myself graduating alongside? The incredible depth and breadth of experience I hear. How does one speak in these times? To people whose Columbia experience has been defined by personal and political struggle, by protest and by the university's response to it. We've been challenged not just to learn, but to act. In making that decision, some of us have paid a price. As we graduate, we should remember that this is the first time since 1968 that a Columbia graduating class has been reduced by suspension for political protest. And the first time since Robert Burke in 1936 that a Columbia class has been reduced by expulsion for political protest.
Excerpts of Peter Gorman giving his valedictory address at Columbia University on Monday. After the ceremony, I spoke to Palestinian-American student activist who also just graduated, Mariam Alwan.
I was arrested and suspended for the first encampment. And actually, I was wearing a Columbia shirt when I was arrested, and that was the last time that I wore the Columbia logo, and now I'm wearing it again now that I'm graduating. I honestly did not think that I would graduate, given the level of repression against pro-Palestinian students. So it's a really powerful moment for me, but at the same time, I feel almost guilty because so many are not able to graduate, not only the students who have been disciplined at Columbia, but also the students at Zim who have been killed. And so I wanted to do everything I can to show that I was thinking of them.
As the reception went on outside the gates of Columbia University, dozens of Columbia professors lined up to hold a vigil around the continued detention of Mahmoud Khalil and other students. This is Columbia Medical School Public Health Biostatistics Professor Melanie Wall.
Melanie Wall, Professor of Biostatistics in the Department of Psychiatry in the Medical Center at Columbia University. The students who've been protesting, and we don't think that the government should, you know, keep this case for anti-Semitism being the excuse for why that our grants are being taken away, and that we have many different things that we're wanting the university to do in terms of self-governance. We are wanting them to not take over the university senate. We're wanting them to allow faculty be part of the choice of the next university president. We want to protect students and scholars from being able to protest. And we want all those things, as well as we want them to fight back against the Trump administration to get our to keep our grants. And so it's not a medical campus.
That was Columbia University biostatistics professor Melanie Wall. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a director of technology to lead our broadcast digital and IT operations. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, and welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Today we have Dr. Etta Fields Black, who's a professor of history here at CMU and who just won the Pulitzer for her book Combi. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Could you take a moment to introduce yourself, what you do here, and what other stuff I may not have mentioned yet?
Sure. So I am a professor in the Department of History, and I teach courses on Africa and the African diaspora, which includes the Middle Passage, pre-colonial courses on pre-colonial African history, modern African history, the Middle Passage, of West African history through film. I also direct the Dietrich College Humanities Center.
So I asked you here to talk today because you did just win the Pulitzer Prize. Can you tell us a little about your book and about the Combahee River Raid?
Sure. So the book is about what happened on June 1st through 3rd, 1863. June 1st, about 9 p.m., Harriet Tubman and her group of spies, scouts, and pilots piloted Colonel James Montgomery, who was the commander of the raid, up the Cumbie River in three armed U.S. gunboats. And aboard were the 2nd South Carolina Volunteers, about 300 black soldiers, and the 3rd Rhode Island Heavy Artillery, one battery of white soldiers. They burned 7 rice plantations in 6 hours, and all the buildings, the stables, the plantation owners' homes, the barns that had the previous year's rice crop in it. They opened the floodgates in the rice fields and destroyed the rice crop that was currently growing there. They burned a bridge at Cumbie Ferry, which would prevent the Confederate planters from trading rice, exporting it, as well as using it to feed Confederate citizens and the Confederate military. And they freed 756 people. And I argue in Cumbie that this was the largest slave rebellion in U.S. history, largest and most successful, and second only to the Haitian Revolution in the history of the New World.
Wow. That's really cool. I also heard you found a family connection to that history.
I did. And a lot of people think that I assume that I wrote the book because my great, great, great grandfather fought in the raid. And no,
no.
I actually learned this in the process of researching the book. I was looking for him and trying to find out more information about the Fields family. At the time that I was starting the book. And so there are connections to the research, but I didn't set out to write a book about him and didn't really know the details. There's still more that we don't know, but I didn't know much besides his name and the name of his son, and father to son down to my great grandfather. I didn't know much about him before I started writing the book.
That makes sense, because from my understanding, this is a pretty hidden history, which is why it's so awesome that you're bringing it to light.
Thank you so much.
So how did you do the research for this? Because I assume it's not as easy as, you know, going down and flipping open other books and learning all about it.
No, it's not. So I was really surprised that so little had been written about the raid, and so little had been written about Harriet Tubman's Civil War service. And I think in large part that's because it's not her service, her leadership is not recorded in the official military record, which to me is not surprising. And what it meant is that I had to look in other places. So I started, and where I found much of the information about Tubman that, you know, historians didn't know before, came from the letters of abolitionists. Mm. Abolitionists with whom Tubman had been in community before the Civil War broke out, after she liberated herself, when she became part of abolitionist networks in Philadelphia, Massachusetts, and upstate New York. And so in the letters of some abolitionists who came down to Beaufort, Port Royal, and the Sea Islands, after a big battle in Beaufort called the Battle of Port Royal in November of 1861, I was able to find them writing letters home about Harriet Tubman and what she was doing. And it was often not the abolitionists themselves, but their children. So William Lloyd Garrison's son, for example, and Frederick Douglass's son, both of whom joined the military. Garrison was in the 55th Massachusetts. Douglass was in the 54th Massachusetts. Both of them were stationed in the area. They encountered Harriet Tubman and they wrote about her. So these were young people who grew up with Tubman, and they volunteered after this Battle of Port Royal to come down as the freedom seekers were adjusting to freedom, and they encountered Harriet Tubman and they wrote about them. For the freedom seekers, and I wanted very much to tell the story of the Cumbie River Raid through the people who were impacted by it, particularly the enslaved people who were liberated in it. And I found those sources at the National Archives, the U.S. Civil War pension files. So I'm using their testimony in the pension files to tell their side of the story.
Do the pension files have what they have to say about things as opposed to what the other people would have to say then?
They are very underused. And in the files, people testify about the raid. They also testify about their families. They testify about community life, courting and weddings and childbirth, going to church, and people who were not going to church and had gotten put out of the church for all kinds of modern behavior, like living with people with whom they were not married. So they talk about, you know, real life, and they talk about it in a way that historians had not seen. You don't see this in the historical literature of slavery, right? To hear people who were born and raised in bondage tell their own stories. And when I say raised, people who, you know, were not free until they were adults. So they spent much of their lives in bondage. We had not heard their stories. And so it is a very, the pension files, U.S. Civil War pension files, are definitely an underutilized resource.
So in terms of Cumbie, you were focusing on telling the story through the eyes of enslaved people. And I know you've also worked on other stuff like Requiem for Rice, which is like